I'm Kimberly Atkins Store, and this is On Point. It's been 18 months since January 6th, 2021, and in the intervening year and a half, we've learned a great deal about that day. We've seen minute-by-minute accounts of how the insurrection unfolded. We've read leaked texts and documents from the organizers of the Stop the Steal rally. We've had trials of those who stormed the Capitol and attempted to overturn the election by force. And this week, we learned even more. The House of Representatives Select Committee investigating January 6th held two hearings yesterday and Tuesday. To explore what we have been learning, I am joined by Andrea Bernstein and Ilya Meritz, investigative journalists and co-hosts of We'll Be Wild, a podcast about the road to January 6th. Andrea is also the author of American Oligarchs, The Kushners, The Trumps, and The Marriage of Money and Power. Hi there, Andrea.
Hey, Kimberly. Great to talk to you.
And hello, Ilya.
Good to be here.
And also with us is On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. Hi, Jack.
Hello, Kimberly. Hello, Ilya and Andrea.
So, Andrea, let's start with you. Simply put, what is the case that the Select Committee is trying to make this week?
So on the first night of the hearings, way back on June 9th, which seems about forever ago, Representative Liz Cheney said that they were going to be unveiling a 7-part plan to block the peaceful transfer of power. They haven't explicitly laid out what the elements of each of those parts are, but we now see a pattern. So this week, the Select Committee focused on two parts. One was what we heard yesterday, which was this really sort of chilling account of this dramatic meeting in the Oval Office on January 3rd, just 3 days before the attack, where the top people in the Justice Department and in the White House counsel's office are arguing for their lives that Trump shouldn't appoint a lower-level Justice Department official who wanted to go along with Trump's plan to essentially invalidate the electoral votes that had already been certified. This lower-level official, Jeffrey Clark, had said he would do it, and it was only after 3 hours almost of arguing that the president decided, well, actually, he was going to abandon that plan because he couldn't get it through. So that is one part of what the Select Committee has called this multi-part coordinated plan to block the peaceful transfer of power. The other part that we heard this week was this wide-ranging, organized, and really, as we learned, coming from former President Trump himself, plan to develop these sets of what's being called fake electors, which is to say, this was after the electoral votes had already been certified. There was an attempt that appears to have been organized by presidential attorney John Eastman and others to put together these slates of alternate slates of electors so that they could make some kind of legally dubious claim that there was a dispute on January 6th. And then we also heard quite a bit about, in last week's hearing, about the president's pressure campaign on Mike Pence, including this dramatic phone call, which he had in front of his whole family at 11:20. So just hours before the, or not even hours, basically an hour and a half before the Capitol was breached, where, according to his own daughter, Trump was having a heated conversation with his vice president. So those are some of the parts of the plan that have come out, and most specifically the ones that have come out this week.
And Ilya, what do you think the committee was trying to achieve by focusing on these points that Andrea just laid out?
Well, I think what the committee is trying to show is the most important ways in which President Trump was conducting a pressure campaign. We've heard that phrase a few times, and what's very striking when you watch the hearings is that that same phrase applies kind of across the board. There was a pressure campaign on Vice President Pence to get him to assert powers that he didn't actually have to invalidate the election. That was coming from the president's lawyer, John Eastman, and from the president himself. There was a pressure campaign on state and local officials, and that changed form over time. But, you know, at points it was about fake electors. It was about invalidating their own vote. And there was a pressure campaign within the Justice Department. And that's what we heard about yesterday. And what was so striking for me in that section is this is the highest law office in the country, right? This is not some podunk office. These are some of the most qualified lawyers in the nation, and the president is telling them, and people who are more knowledgeable about the law than the president himself by a great deal, and he's telling them, you got to do this thing, you got to intervene in the election. And they're coming back and saying, actually, the Department of Justice doesn't have very much of a role to play in the election. You know, the broad outlines of what we've learned from these hearings would be familiar to somebody who read the New York Times and the Washington Post really, really closely. But what's new here for me, and what I think is so powerful, is these eyewitness accounts, people who were in the room with the president, people who were his lawyers or his campaign advisors, telling us, telling the American public what they told him, which is that you lost the election and what you're proposing is not lawful.
And one of the committee's main aims this week was to tie President Trump directly to these efforts to stop the Electoral College's certification of President Biden's victory. One piece of evidence they put forward was the testimony of Ronna McDaniel, the current chairwoman of the Republican National Committee, about a call she received from Mr. Trump and his lawyer, John Eastman.
What did the president say when he called you?
Essentially, he turned the call over to Mr. Eastman, who then proceeded to talk about the importance of the RNC helping the campaign gather these contingent electors in case any of the legal challenges that were ongoing changed the result of any of the states. I think more just helping them reach out and assemble them. But my understanding is the campaign did take the lead, and we just were helping them in that role.
So, Andrea, I find this comment just fascinating for a number of reasons, both the fact that Ronna McDaniel is testifying, but also really trying to downplay the connection and saying, no, it was really the campaign. You know, we were just helping just in case. What's your take about the McDaniel testimony?
I found that piece of tape stunning. And one of the things that's been interesting about these hearings is these short videos that have been put together by the committee where they have various investigators explaining pieces of the evidence that they've uncovered. I mean, just as an aside, as a journalist, it's immensely satisfying to sort of see the, you know, oversight in government actually working and having people respond to congressional questions. And what we are seeing is these witnesses, all of them Republicans, so far as we know, all of them Trump supporters, laying out the story of what happened. So in this video, what Ronna McDaniels is saying is that the plan to create false electors originated with Trump. She said Trump started this phone call, turned it over to John Eastman, this attorney, who then laid out the plan to create these so-called fake electors. And that, to me, was stunning. And in this video, it wasn't just her. If you watch the whole thing, you see a number of officials, including there's a clip, I think it was in this one, of Eastman himself describing the plan. And you hear all of these Republican officials telling the Select Committee, yes, this is how the president and or his intermediaries put pressure on me to do this thing. And we saw on Tuesday, Rusty Bowers, the Arizona Secretary of State, telling us, I told the president I couldn't do this. But he still felt the pressure up to and including on January 6.
And Ilya, of course, something that had been previously reported but really was brought home by these hearings was the direction from President Trump to the DOJ to in some way, whether in a press conference or by installing his own attorney general, to call the election corrupt and, quote, leave the rest to me and the Republican congressman. What do you think of that?
Yeah, that was just an incredibly stunning moment, kind of a standout moment as well from yesterday's hearing. So the call it corrupt and leave the rest to me, I'm paraphrasing slightly, is taken from contemporaneous notes written by Richard Donahue, who was the acting assistant, the acting deputy attorney general at the time. He had only just become acting, I believe a day before Christmas. And he said that pretty much every day, sometimes more than once a day, he was hearing from the president pursuant to this pressure campaign. And at one point, he's in a meeting with the president. He realizes that he has to memorialize the things that he's hearing because they are so outside of the mainstream and so deeply, deeply unusual. And so he starts writing it down. I do think we need to dwell on how unusual this is. The Justice Department is a part of the executive branch, but by tradition and really by design, it is an independent agency. It has a degree of independence. The president can certainly pick the attorney general, but the attorney general then has to steer the course for the agency. And what Donahue and also the acting attorney general at the time, Jeff Rosen, told us yesterday is that pretty much every day from Christmas Eve through January 3rd, maybe through January 6th, they were hearing from the president and he was saying, you got to do something. And the calls were getting more urgent every time. That is just a remarkable, remarkable thing.
Yeah.
Usually these officials would try to keep the president at arm's length and only occasionally meet with him precisely so that they could preserve their independence.
And Kimberly, if I could just jump in and
just add a couple
to what
seconds,
Ali just
yeah.
said, these are people who were Trump loyalists. Trump had handpicked them because he thought that they were loyal to him. And they said, we are your loyalists.
Right.
So that's how far it had come.
We'll have to pause there. We're talking this hour about what we have been learning from the January 6th committee and the efforts to overturn the 2020 election. Stay with us. I'm Kimberly Atkins-Storr. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Kimberly Atkins-Storr. We're looking back at this week's hearings by the House of Representatives Committee investigating the January 6th attack on the Capitol. I'm joined by On Point's news analyst, Jack Beattie, and by Andrea Bernstein and Ilya Meretz, investigative journalist and co-host of Will Be Wild, a podcast about the road to January 6th. So I want to talk now about the case that the committee is laying out, the case for the prosecution, if you will, we can call it that. One key witness on Tuesday was Rusty Bowers, Speaker of the Arizona State House. Speaker Bowers told the committee that he was put under immense pressure to reconvene the legislature so the state's electoral votes could be flipped from Joe Biden to Donald Trump. That pressure came right from the top.
I saw that the White House on my Bluetooth was calling, and I took the call and was asked by the operator at the White House, if I would hold for the president, which I did, and Mr. Giuliani came on first, and niceties, then President Trump came on, and we initiated a conversation.
So, Ilya, this testimony really felt like a bombshell. Talk about this and some of the other really important testimony from this week.
You know, my takeaway from this in part was that after the election, so much of the government was occupied with the election, even though it was decisively won by Joe Biden in the popular vote and decisively in the electoral vote. You had Rusty Bowers, you had his equivalents in places like Pennsylvania and Michigan, hearing from the president, dealing with all this incoming from him. And you had other parts of the government, like the Department of Justice, like the FBI, like the vice president, and they're all having to deal with the storyline that the president was putting out there, which, you know, because by virtue of his very large megaphone and his very large following, he was able to create some currency around the lie that the election was fraudulent, that he hadn't really lost, that in fact he had won. And so what Rusty Bowers was telling us is that he was on the receiving end of a long-running, very intrusive campaign, and the president wouldn't take no for an answer. And it's particularly striking with someone like Rusty Bowers because he is known as a dyed-in-the-wool conservative and somebody who voted for Trump, but somebody who was also extremely serious about the responsibilities of his office and basically said, you're asking me to overturn the will of the people of Arizona and to go back on my oath out of loyalty to you. I'm not going to do it. And the president was unwilling to hear it. And the price that Rusty Bowers paid was just a slew of harassment, calls to his phone in the middle of the night, people coming to his home. And we saw this repeated in lots of other places. When the president turned his wrath on someone, his supporters really turned out and made those people's lives hell.
Yeah, and Jack, it shows that this contingent election strategy wasn't just some spontaneous, willy-nilly thing. It was fairly organized, and it led directly to the president.
Indeed, and it led directly to his character. To me, that was the big takeaway from Tuesday's hearing, that and the vista it opened on Mr. Trump's criminal exposure in the state of Georgia. The Brennan Center has found that 1 in 5 election workers currently plan to retire by 2024. They don't want to stay in for another presidential election. And 1 in 6 election workers have been threatened. Typical of them were the Georgia election workers we heard from on Tuesday, Shea Moss and her mother, Ruby Freeman, who suffered, whose lives were upended by Trump's fingering them as vote hustlers.
Yeah.
And indeed, even Ruby's mother, that is Shea's grandmother, had her home busted into by people looking to make a citizen's arrest. Now, we have to ask ourselves, what sort of a man would finger, as the president of the United States, people, innocent people just doing their jobs? Well, I submit that this is very strong evidence for a comment that Mitch McConnell has made about Donald Trump. In a recent book, he says Donald Trump, quote, is a despicable human being. I'm not saying that. That's what he said. And I think the evidence that those election workers presented is very strong, predicate to sustain that characterological judgment, because it all goes back to that, doesn't it? This ruthless, this desperate character, stopping at nothing, yeah, at threatening violence, doing whatever he can merely to hold on to office. That's the man at the center. That's the character of the man.
And I'm glad you brought up Shea Moss, Jack, because that was, to me, some of the most compelling testimony we heard this week. Shea Moss, of course, is the Georgia poll worker who talked about the hatred she faced after Rudy Giuliani falsely accused her and her mother, Ruby Freeman, a fellow poll worker, of tampering with the election.
I just don't do nothing anymore. I don't want to go anywhere. I second guess everything that I do. It's affecting my life in a major way, in every way, all because of lies. For me doing my job, same thing I've been doing forever.
Now, Andrea, that testimony was so powerful, but this isn't just about eliciting emotion, right? The committee is trying to make a legal point here. Help us understand that.
Yes. So, I mean, I think that, you know, obviously the ramifications of that testimony go in many different directions. The story, the backstory of Shea Moss and Ruby Freeman is that they were election workers in the State Farm Arena in Fulton County, Georgia, Atlanta. And on the night of the election, they were told that they were going to go home, that they were done for the night. And then the person who told them that, a supervisor, said, oh, no, sorry, mistake, go back. So in the interim, they put away the ballots they were counting, and then they took them out. And President Trump and his attorney Rudy Giuliani and other associates played snippets of this video and claimed falsely that there were some kind of suitcases under the table, of which there were none, and that they were stuffing them with stuffing, according to Trump, Trump ballots with fake Biden ballots. Now, what do we know about that? Well, what we learned yesterday was that his acting attorney general, Jeff Rosen, his acting deputy attorney general, Rich Donahue, said to the president repeatedly, that is a false story. There are no suitcases under the table. He was told this over and over and over again, and yet he continued to push this lie. So the case that's being built is all of these lawyers at the top of the Justice Department, at the top of the White House counsel, the White House counsel's office, even from his campaign, said, Mr. President, what you are doing is wrong. There is no basis for it. It may be illegal. It's not legally sound. And the result is what we learn, what we just heard from Shea Moss, which is this terror campaign that is perpetrated when people hear these lies. So that is the sort of case that the committee is building, was that the president knew or should have known that these were material falsehoods. Representative Cheney used those words yesterday, and yet he continued to push them for his own benefit. And that, the legal argument is, of course, there hasn't been an indictment, it hasn't been tested, but the legal argument is that that is being part of a conspiracy to defraud the United States.
And it wasn't just the president and his campaign, but various members of Congress as well who engaged in this. Members such as Andy Biggs, who tried to get Arizona State Speaker Rusty Bowers to declare Joe Biden's victory false there. He wasn't the only congressman allegedly to have been involved in the plot. Another was Matt Gaetz, a now former Florida congressman. Eric Hirschman, a Trump lawyer, says that Mr. Gaetz was concerned that his efforts on behalf of the campaign would be illegal, and he wanted Mr. Trump's help.
Was Representative Gaetz requesting a pardon?
Believe so. The general tone was, we may get prosecuted because we were defensive of, you know, the president's positions on these things. A pardon that he was discussing, requesting, was as broad as you could describe from the beginning. I remember he's from the beginning of time up until today, for any and all things. He mentioned Nixon, and I said Nixon's pardon was never nearly that broad.
So, Jack, first of all, asking for a pardon seems to me to indicate that you are aware that you may be doing something that may will be deemed illegal. And then the breadth of these pardons that would cover more than even those in the Nixon era. What does that say to you, Jack?
Well, it says that this is, that the other branch of government was involved in this, too. Trump, in the telephone call with Rich Donahue, on which Donahue made notes, he said, all I want you to do, the Justice Department, is to declare this election corrupt. Leave the rest to me and the Republican congressman. Well, that puts them right in the crosshairs of prosecution with the president, and it can't be good news for any of them. And as Adam Kinzinger said, who presented the case for the committee, you don't ask for a pardon unless you suspect, at the least, that you've done something wrong. And then add to that Ron Johnson, whom we learned about something on Tuesday. He's the senator from Wisconsin and a Trump ultra. And he seemed to be involved in, and his staff did, in transmitting fake ballots from, fake elector ballots from Wisconsin to Vice President Pence. They didn't get there, but his office was the intermediary for this fake set of electors who were going to, on the day of the riot, change the outcome. So he's in trouble, too.
So I want to talk about what you just mentioned before that, Jack, is one of the threads from this week's hearing, the accusation that President Trump tried to co-opt the Department of Justice in his efforts to cling to power illegal. And it seems that it only wasn't successful because he ran out of time. The committee heard from former acting Deputy Attorney General Richard Donahue, who spoke about his clashes with Jeffrey Clark, a pro-Trump DOJ lawyer.
I certainly remember very specifically the conversation in the meeting on January 2nd. That got even more confrontational, but he was defensive and, similar to his earlier reaction when I said this is nothing less than Justice Department meddling in an election, his reaction was, I think a lot of people have meddled in this election. And so he kind of clung to that and then spewed out some of these theories, some of which we'd heard from the president, but others which were floating around the internet and media, and just kept insisting that the department needed to act and needed to send those letters.
I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store. This is On Point. So, Ilya, what do you take away from Donahue's testimony? How close was the DOJ to becoming Donald Trump's personal agency?
You know, Andrea Bernstein, who's also in this convo, and I, before we had the podcast Will Be Wild looking at January 6th, we had a different podcast examining President Trump and his conflicts of interest. It was called Trump Inc. And one of the questions that really has come up in our reporting for, at this point, like 4 or 5 years is what's going to protect us better from a lawless president? Is it individuals or is it systems? There's always some tension there. And I feel like what we saw happen in the Justice Department was a really potent manifestation of that, because the president was going to individuals, the head of his Justice Department, the Deputy Attorney General as well, and saying, I need you to do this. And they were saying the system won't allow it. And somebody else named Jeffrey Clark, who also worked at the Justice Department, effectively kind of raised his hand and said, well, I would do this. I would send a letter to Georgia officials and tell them that I suspect fraud in the vote there and that they should re-examine the vote. And so what we see is just an incredibly vivid distillation of I think, how close we came. And in the end, it is both systems and individuals, or individuals acting within a system that can hold that system together. But it does seem that we came really, really close. And it's from Richard Donahue's testimony. He describes this Sunday, January 3rd, late day meeting with himself, quite a few other kind of senior White House lawyers and Justice Department officials, and also Jeffrey Clark, the guy putting himself forward to do Trump's bidding, at least in Donahue's telling. And that meeting goes on for about 3 hours. And the argument that seems to win the day with the president, and again, we don't have the president's point of view here. Mm-hmm. This is Richard Donahue's point of view. His argument is, you can't do this in 3 days. You couldn't get it. Even if you tried, you couldn't get it done in 3 days. There'd be mass resignations. There'd be pandemonium in the Department of Justice. And so even replacing the acting attorney general at this late date with just 3 days to go before the certification of the electoral vote, it's not going to work.
Yes. And Andrea, just quickly before our break, we've heard about how the links to violence happened well before January 6th. Here's how Arizona State Speaker Rusty Bowers described his experience since he was made a target.
We have various groups come by and they have had video panel trucks with videos of me proclaiming me to be a pedophile and a pervert and a corrupt and politician, and blaring loudspeakers in my neighborhood and leaving literature both on my property, but arguing and threatening with neighbors and with myself.
Andrea, this was long before January 6th. What does that tell us?
Yes, I mean, I think that the link between the big lie and violence is one of the recurring themes that has shown up. And, you know, we've heard this in these hearings, the officials who've been threatened. I mean, this is a Republican Secretary of State, a Trump loyalist. When we were interviewing people for our podcast, Will Be Wild, Every single former Trump administration official that I spoke to talked about being threatened by violence. Some of them had to hire security guards to protect their families. Some of them had to move. We see this over and over again. It was something that was known even before January 6th, that the president's words could and did lead to violence. So while we see that track, we also see this other track of him trying to, you know, overturn the Justice Department. Representative Kinzinger said yesterday, largely to these men.
I'm going to pause you right there. Talking this hour about what we've been learning from the January 6th committee about the attack on the Capitol in efforts to turn the 2020 election. I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store. I'm joined by On Point's news analyst, Jack Beatty, and by Andrea Bernstein and Ilya Meretz, investigative journalist and co-host of Will Be Wild, a podcast about the road to January 6th. So far, we've talked about the testimony and evidence that we saw at this week's hearing, but I want to step back a little bit now to really ask how effective this presentation has been. And I guess that begins, Andrea, by figuring out what is the goal. Is the goal trying to tie up all of this evidence to make a case for conspiracy to obstruct an official proceeding and therefore really give the DOJ its guide to moving forward with criminal proceedings?
I mean, I think there are sort of multi-stranded goals here. As a select committee, the sort of, you know, most direct role that the committee has is to gather information and to potentially propose legislation that could correct some of the deficiencies that allowed this to happen. So that's on its most basic level. There are many secondary goals, which I think, you know, as the committee members have articulated, they see as equally important. One is to lay out the story for history, and they really have done a very good job at this. And you can see what happens when you have a kind of persistent investigation like this, where they got 1,000 witnesses to testify under oath. Now, of course, some of them took the Fifth, but many of them decided they didn't want to go that route. Many of them decided they were going to truthfully answer the questions, even though they supported and still support President Trump. So they are telling this story for history, which I think is vastly important and cannot be underrated, because we do understand a great deal more about the truth of what happened than we did at the beginning of the month. And then the last goal, I think, of the committee is sort of, you know, kind of hinted at by a number of the members, is to get the attention of the Justice Department and to create pressure on the Justice Department to bring a serious criminal case and an investigation. And we saw the confluence of these two things yesterday, where Jeffrey Clark, who was this lower-level Justice Department official, who I think it's important to note, one of the members of Congress who has sort of come under scrutiny here, Representative Scott Perry of Pennsylvania, appears to have promoted the idea of elevating Jeffrey Clark inside the Justice Department. And according to White House logs presented yesterday, President Trump already had started calling him the acting attorney general. So it seems like it wasn't just somebody Trump met and decided to bring in, but an actual plan. So the question is, regarding Jeffrey Clark, who is also being investigated, is there going to be an elevated pressure on Merrick Garland and on the U.S. Department of Justice to criminally prosecute the president? That is out of the hands of the committee, but certainly by raising all this to public attention, it creates pressure on prosecutors. I mean, that happens all the time, yeah, where somebody, journalists or someone who brings a civil case, will raise something that may be criminal matter and the Justice Department opens an investigation. So there is an investigation, as we know, because Jeffrey Clark was, his home was raided yesterday and electronic devices and documents were taken. But the question is how far up will that go? Will it go into the White House? We just don't know. And that is one of the sort of, you know, we won't know until we know.
Yeah. And Jack, I think that's really important. We don't know until we know. But the vice chair, Congresswoman Cheney, brings up frequently this ruling by a California judge saying that Trump likely committed a crime, essentially. So how much do you think this is a message to the DOJ? Now, the committee is empowered to make criminal referrals, but the DOJ does not need a criminal referral from this committee to act.
Nor does the district attorney of Fulton County, Alabama, Ms. Fawny Willis. She is conducting an investigation. She's impaneled a grand jury, and they're going to have 50 witnesses. And they're investigating Trump's state crimes against the state of Georgia, including criminal solicitation to commit election fraud, of which his notorious phone call with the Georgia Secretary of State would be Exhibit A. But in addition, there are as many as 12 other misdemeanors and felonies that the district attorney of Fulton County is investigating and will decide, she says, perhaps by this fall, whether to indict Trump. And of course, again, the threat of violence is in the air. She has had to put her staff in bulletproof vests. And she cited this week warnings that Trump made recently. Trump said that he will call for mass protests if, quote, racist or vicious and unfair prosecutors do something he doesn't like. In other words, Trump is threatening, a mini January 6th in Fulton County and elsewhere to use the threat of violence to, deter prosecutions against him. And the response to the, in other words, if there is violence and he seems to be threatening it, that'll be another message to Merrick Garland on the other side of the ledger. He can say, my God, do I really want to stir up mass violence and protest to go after Donald Trump?
And Ilya, there's going to be a pause in this presentation from the committee. Instead of having more hearings next week, they've pushed that off into July. What does that tell you? Does that mean that they are still finding more information and they're still processing that?
Yeah, it does suggest that pretty strongly. And I've been struck as well at points during the proceedings when members, particularly Liz Cheney, the ranking member, and Benny Thompson, the chair of the committee, have explicitly said, hey, we're taking tips. Go to our website. Earlier this week, Congresswoman Cheney closed out her remarks on the, I believe, Tuesday session, directly addressing former White House counsel Pat Cipollone. Pat Cipollone was, essentially the top in White House lawyer inside the White House advising President Trump on his options. His name has come up many, many times in testimony because he is somebody who seems to have been pulling the handbrake while President Trump was pressing the gas on his schemes to try to intervene in the election. But Cipollone has not spoken with the committee on the record, he certainly isn't scheduled yet to say anything publicly. Liz Cheney made a big play for him. We also learned this week that there was a documentary filmmaker embedded with the Trump campaign and around the Trump White House that a lot of people didn't know about. And he has agreed to give his footage to the committee. So I think the surprise here is that these public hearings have actually been a really helpful investigative tool. Usually you think of public hearings as kind of being a sideshow, you know, while the staff write, you know, do the interviews and write their report. But in this instance, focusing the public's attention in this way, perhaps, you know, I'm getting the impression, maybe actually helping the committee, both in sort of focusing the public's mind on this, but also focusing the mind of people who representatives on the committee really want to hear from. So we're expecting two more sessions in July, and it seems that the door is open to more sessions even after that. The one that I'm particularly focused on that I really want to hear, they've already told us that they're going to give us a view from inside the White House on January 6th. That is one of the pieces of this puzzle that has not been fully reported. Mm-hmm. We don't understand what the President's day looked like, who he was talking to, what he was thinking and saying over the course of the day. So that's going to be one to definitely not miss.
So we are talking about how this all ties together in the committee's case of how it all ties together. Here's how Committee Vice Chair Republican Liz Cheney put the committee's theory of the case.
Donald Trump had a direct and personal role in this effort, as did Rudy Giuliani, as did John Eastman. In other words, the same people who were attempting to pressure Vice President Mike Pence to reject electoral votes illegally were also simultaneously working to reverse the outcome of the 2020 election at the state level. Each of these efforts to overturn the election is independently serious. Each deserves attention both by Congress and by our Department of Justice. But as a federal court has already indicated, these efforts were also part of a broader plan. And all of this was done in preparation for January 6th.
So, Andrea, this is what the Republicans on the committee are saying. This is the case that they're making because there are no pro-Trump Republicans on this committee. They're boycotting it. And Trump himself seems to indicate that he wishes the GOP wasn't boycotting because this is very different. This presentation is different from either one of his impeachments, for example, when you had pro-Trump Republicans defending him continuously throughout, as well as during the Robert Mueller hearings where you had the same thing. There's this unity of purpose among the committee. Talk about how that's very different and why that might be hitting the president differently.
So in the course of putting together our podcast, Will Be Wild, Ilya and I began watching congressional hearings, you know, quite early, obviously watching the impeachment, the second impeachment trial. But there were hearings that took place through the course of the spring of 2021, and they were just all heat and no light because you had some of these Republican members of the House of Representatives, including some of the people that we now know asked for pardons, spending their 5 minutes just basically restating the big lie. And so when Kevin McCarthy, when House Speaker, House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy posed the idea of having Jim Jordan and others that were very much and are still espousing the big lie on the committee, Speaker Nancy Pelosi rejected that. So what you have is this committee of seven Democrats, two Republicans who've been effectively excommunicated by their party, but all dedicated to finding out what happened. So this is extremely different from any of the other congressional hearings or impeachment trials that we've watched because it is all about revealing information. Now, we don't have the backstory. There is no cross-examination. If there was a criminal trial, obviously, there'd be a defense case mounted. But I do think that this is really serving the truth of what happened. And, you know, referring back to Judge Carter's decision, this was civil case about whether John Eastman's email should be released to the committee, and most of them were, and I think we've seen the fruits of that in this investigation. But Judge Carter, a federal judge in the Ninth District, did say that he thought it was more likely than not that the president had committed crime. So what the committee is sort of doing here is giving that argument momentum. Now, I think one of the big questions that people still have on their minds is, did the president somehow organize the violence at the Capitol? We know he told people to go and fight on January 6th. We know he told them to go march to the Capitol. But that is still a big question that I sort of, did he have any prior knowledge that we still don't know? And maybe we'll learn that in the hearings to come.
And Ilya, is there any idea after this pause, once these hearings resume, that there might be some sort of side campaign to among the pro-Trump Republicans to try to message his side, since he's indicated that he's not pleased with the fact that he doesn't have that kind of defense? Or is the fact that so many of them are a part of this investigation make that more difficult?
Well, I think there's definitely going to be messaging from the Republican side, and precisely what form that's going to take, we'll have to see. I don't think that they have succeeded to the president's satisfaction so far. And, you know, frankly, there is a weakness to only hearing the prosecution's view. You know, we've seen a lot of video clips from people like Ronna McDaniel, head of the RNC, Jason Miller, a Trump advisor, lots of people who were close to Trump, but they've been, you know, very brief. So a 12-second clip doesn't tell you the substance of everything that Ronna McDaniel had to say or Jason Miller. And what I hope is that eventually the committee is going to lay down this story in a more fulsome way. The committee is charged with authoring a report. I think that's a good thing. All indications are they want to write a report that will actually be read and be readable and interesting. But I think they need to go one step further. I think they need to release deposition transcripts, documents, materials they've gathered, possibly video, and really create a body of information that Americans can turn to when they try to understand this very troubling and aberrant and unusual chapter in our history, the only non-peaceful transfer of power in our history.
So, Jack, what more do you want to hear? What do you think the case, what part of the case is this committee yet to make, and do you think they need to make?
Well, I hope that they tell viewers what the federal statutes are and what the penalties are that are involved in them. You know, the fraud on the United States and interfering with an official government proceeding, these can carry as much as 20 years in jail. For the rest of his natural life, Mr. Trump could be facing prison on those charges. I hope we hear about just what the stakes are for him. But, you know, the question is this cutting through? And I just was looking at the figures. In April, 52% said Trump should be criminally charged. Now it's 58%. So there's some movement there. 25% of Republicans are watching. I think that's significant. That's a lot. Now, the first hearing was in prime time. That got 20 million viewers. That sounds wonderful until you realize that's the Macy's Thanksgiving parade audience. So we don't know. It's not the mass event that Watergate was, but it may be beginning to cut through. And the strategy of having all the voices for the prosecution essentially be Republicans, That may be influencing that 25% of Republicans watching.
Jack Beatty, On Point News Analyst, thank you as always.
Thank you.
And thank you to Ilya Meritz and Andrea Bernstein, co-hosts of the podcast Will Be Wild. Andrea is also the author of American Oligarchs, The Kushners, The Trumps, and The Marriage of Money and Power. Thanks to you both.
Great speaking with you.
Thank you so much.
I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store. This is On Point.